Bhagavad Gita as it is, presented by Srila Prabhupada, we're going to read from chapter 10, text 9. This is a very well-known verse. Lord Krishna says, Machita madgata prana bodhiyanta parasparam katayantas cha mam nityam tu shanti cha ramanti cha. The thoughts of my pure devotees dwell in me, their lives are surrendered to me, and they derive great satisfaction and bliss, enlightening one another and conversing about me, which is what we're doing here. Krishna is describing what we're doing here. So, Prabhupada's purport. Pure devotees whose characteristics are mentioned here engage themselves fully in the transcendental loving service of the Lord. Their minds cannot be diverted from the lotus feet of Krishna. Their talks are solely on the transcendental subjects, which include practical devotional service, as Prabhupada demonstrated. The symptoms of the pure devotees are described in this verse specifically. Devotees of the Supreme Lord are 24 hours daily engaged in glorifying the pastimes of the Supreme Lord. Their hearts and souls are constantly submerged in Krishna, and they take pleasure in discussing him with other devotees. Again, judging from Prabhupada's own example, always glorifying the pastimes of the Lord. Of course, in this age, Krishna's pastime is saving the world, as it was in the past. When Krishna personally appeared to remove the burden of the earth, and of course, Lord Varaha, and so many different incarnations of the Lord saved the world. And so discussing, trying to understand how to serve Krishna's mission in this world is certainly also what Prabhupada is talking about based on his own example. In the preliminary stage of devotional service, devotees relish the transcendental pleasure from the service itself, and in the mature stage, they're actually situated in love of God. Once situated in that transcendental position, they can relish the highest perfection which is exhibited by the Lord in his abode. Lord Chaitanya likens transcendental devotional service to the sowing of a seed in the heart of the living entity. There are innumerable living entities traveling throughout the different planets of the universe, and out of them, there are a few who are fortunate enough to meet a pure devotee and get the chance to understand devotional service. So all of us have had that fortune by meeting the teachings of Prabhupada. This devotional service is just like a seed, and if it is sown in the heart of a living entity, and if he goes on hearing and chanting, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. That seed fructifies just as the seed of a tree fructifies with regular watering. The spiritual plant of devotional service gradually grows and grows until it penetrates the covering of the material universe and enters into the Brahmajyoti effulgence in the spiritual sky. In the spiritual sky also, that plant grows more and more until it reaches the highest planet, which is called Goloka Vrindavan, the supreme planet of Krishna. Ultimately, the plant takes shelter under the lotus feet of Krishna and rests there. Gradually, as a plant grows fruits and flowers, that plant of devotional service also produces fruits, and the watering process in the form of chanting and hearing goes on. This plant of devotional service is fully described in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. It is explained there that when the complete plant takes shelter under the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord, one becomes fully absorbed in love of God. Then one cannot live even for a moment without being in contact with the Supreme Lord, just as a fish cannot live without water. In such a state, the devotee actually attains the transcendental qualities in contact with the Supreme Lord. The Srimad Bhagavatam is also full of such narration about the relationship between the Supreme Lord and his devotees. Therefore, the Srimad Bhagavatam is very dear to the devotees. In this narration, there is nothing about material activities. sense gratification, or liberation. Srimad Bhagavatam is the only narration in which the transcendental nature of the Supreme Lord and his devotees is fully described. Thus, the realized souls in Krishna consciousness take continual pleasure in hearing such transcendental literatures, just as a young boy and girl take pleasure in association. Prabhupada ki jai. So, Lord Krishna states here, machitta, those whose minds, chitta, are in me, machitta, madgata prana, and their prana. The word prana, of course, means the vital breath, the vital air. It also comes in Sanskrit, means the vital energy. And so, in other words, it's something like saying with your very self, your innermost being, at one level, that with your vital strength, your very life energy, that life energy has literally gone to me, Krishna says. It's interesting because Krishna doesn't merely say your arms and legs sometimes do things for me, or but your prana, your very life force, has gone to me. If we look very carefully at these words in Sanskrit, they're interesting. Gata. Gata, of course, is the past passive participle. As you know from the Sanskrit word gam, which means to go. It's, the English word is from Sanskrit. Ga, go, same word. So here the word gata. Gata means gone. So Krishna, the idea here is not that here I am in my little world in which I happily am the leading player, star, and so on. And in my little world, out of my piety and my good sense, I sometimes offer things to Krishna. Like from my little self-centered world, I throw offerings over the wall of my pride to Krishna. That's not the image here. The image here is that we have gone to Krishna. We've actually gone to him. Our vital force has gone to him. So that whatever activity we perform with our mind, with our limbs, with our speech, whatever activity we perform, ultimately the foundation of that is our vital strength. And that if that vital strength has gone to Krishna, if that vital force has gone to Krishna for his service, then anything we do automatically is Krishna-centric. It is Krishna conscious. This is the natural state of the soul. There's a beautiful verse in the Bhagavatam that says, Yatha taror mula nishechanena tripyanti tatskanda bujopasaka pranopahara yathendriyanam tataiva sarvarhanam achuteja. The verse begins yatha, introducing an analogy, just as taror mula nishechanena, just as by watering the root of a tree. You probably, those of you who've been around here long enough, have heard that one. But actually, it's right out of the Bhagavatam. Just as by watering the root of a tree, it's exactly what it says. By watering the root of a tree, tripyanti tatskanda bujopashaka, the tree, the buja, or the skanda of a tree means its trunk. The trunk of the tree, buja, the arms of the tree, which mean the branches. So that the trunk of the tree, the arms, the branches of the tree, upashaka, the twigs, upashaka literally means a junior branch. So in Sanskrit, that means a twig. So, just as by watering the root of a tree, tripyanti tatskanda bujopashaka, the trunk, the branches, the twigs, everything is satisfied by watering the root. We don't water the trunk. We don't water the branches. We don't water the twigs. We water the trunk, the root, the root of the tree. So, another example, pranopaharat. Just as by nourishing, by bringing nourishment, again, to the prana, which here means with like your stomach. In other words, when you eat, the food perhaps first touches your hand or your fork or spoon or whatever. It goes into your mouth, and your mouth does its thing on the food, unless you're a sort of a high-powered, quick-acting American that just gulps down his food. But some people in this country still take time to chew. So you chew your food, and then it goes down your neck and eventually makes its way to the stomach. So it has its little, you know, magical journey through your body. But ultimately, it has to get to your stomach. That's where the nutrition actually happens. It has to come to your stomach. And by doing that, by furnishing food in that way, nourishing the stomach, all the limbs of the body are satisfied. Pranopahara jitendriyanam. So what's the analogy here? Tataiva. Exactly in that way, exactly in the way that you satisfy a tree, all of it, by watering the root, or you satisfy a body by putting food in the stomach, everything that should be done, everything that is worthy to be done in life, is done if we worship Krishna. Sarvarhana. Arhanam in Sanskrit means doing what is worthy, doing what is appropriate. Everything will be done if we worship Krishna. And this is elaborated upon in the Chaitanya Charitamrita with the statement that Shadha Shabde Vishasakaheshu did the Nishaya. Krishna Bhakti Kaile Sarva Karma Kritahoy. This means that the word faith, I mean, you can test yourself here to see, we should all test ourselves to see to what extent do I believe in Krishna. As we know from the Bhagavad Gita, the divisions of faith, which is, isn't that chapter 17? I hope I'm not that rusty. Yes, it is chapter 17. Krishna explains that there's not one thing called faith. There's not just one thing called faith. There are different levels of faith. Faith has to mature. And in fact, there is a type of faith which in Sanskrit takes a different word. When we hear about faith in this world, we generally think, oh, do you believe in God? You know, how many people in America believe in God? How many people don't believe in God? So merely believing in the existence of God is called astikyam, from the Sanskrit word asti, which means he exists. So if you believe in the statement asti, he exists, that is called astikyam. It's one of the qualities of a Brahman. But then you have the word shraddha, an ancient Sanskrit word, which literally means to put your heart into something. Shrad in Sanskrit is heart. And dha means to place. So shrad, dha, to place your heart, to put your heart in something. And even then, there are different levels of this. And ultimately, there's the transcendental faith. Just like in that verse where Krishna speaks of Shadhaya Pariyopetas, endowed with transcendental faith. So real faith, transcendental faith, not merely believing that God exists, not merely believing that Krishna exists. Because you may believe that Krishna exists, I may believe that, but I may not be clear about what Krishna is. I may think there is such an entity as Krishna, maybe Krishna's even God, but what do I think God is? What do I think the nature of God is? People have had very many different views on the nature of God. Therefore, Krishnadas Kaviraj tells what real faith is from Krishna conscious point of view. He says, Shraddha Shadde, by the word Shraddha, Vishwasakahe, one is saying trust. By the word faith, one is actually saying trust. Shraddha Shadde Vishwasakahe, then he elaborates, Sudridha Nishchaya, a very firm conviction. Sudridha Nishchaya, a very firm conviction. So what is the trust? What is the very firm conviction? Krishna Bhakti Koile, by rendering loving service to Krishna, Sarva Karma Krita Hoy, every action will be done. Every action will be done. If I devote myself to Krishna. Devotional service is practical. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Chatur Varnyam Maya Srishtam, by me, the system of four vocational orders has been created. The Varna system. In other words, Krishna serving Krishna doesn't mean to become impractical. In fact, one of the qualities of Vaishnav is that a Vaishnav is daksha, expert, from which, of course, daksha, we get the English word dexterous. So, a Vaishnav is expert. A Vaishnav is practical. Prabhupada was most... When I took sannyas in 1972, at the mature old age of 23, sometimes think it's like those cartoons where someone runs, is running on the roof of a building and runs off the roof and keeps running in the air as long as he doesn't look down. Anyway, now I forgot what I was going to say. But oh, yes. After I just thought of... So, when I took sannyas, I wrote a letter to Prabhupada saying, well, Prabhupada, you know, I was a temple president before, now I've taken sannyas, so I won't be encumbered by practical management. I can just travel and preach now. And Prabhupada wrote back, who told you this? He said, why don't you do what I'm doing? In the morning I give the Bhagavatam class, and in the afternoon I go to the bank. Now, as we know, Prabhupada was a pure soul, completely free of selfish desires. He never spent a single penny for his selfish interests. He actually not only gave all his money to serve Krishna, to try to save the world and enlighten it and save people from suffering, not only did he spend every penny he ever got to help other people, he actually gave his own physical life. At an age when he should have been resting, he was traveling around the world, and eventually his health gave out. So Prabhupada not only gave every penny he ever received as a donation, he literally gave his life for us. That's a practical fact. So I now will risk all of the goodwill I have here today by speaking of a dreaded subject, which is, and that is membership in ISKCON of Atlanta. And, yes. So, there is a... There's an irony, there's a paradox in this world, which is that in order to organize efficiently and spread spiritual teaching so that many people can get relief and knowledge and a good life and ultimately eternal life, in order to achieve that, there has to be practical means to organize. And so there's this paradoxical situation where the very people who are supposed to be most detached from material things sometimes seem to be thinking about them all the time and trying to get them from others. So sometimes you'll get it sort of like this confusing 1-2 punch where you'll get a heavy lecture on, you know, how we should give up material things, and then the next point is, by the way, please give us your material things. So, and actually, if you study the history of religion, I have to some extent, but if you study, for example, if you study the history of Christian monasticism, or for that matter, the Sufi tradition, which was sort of the, actually, India-inspired bhakti tradition of Islam, which was non-fanatical, and therefore persecuted by the fanatics. But anyway, if you study the history of religion, you find this cycle where you get a group of people who are really sincere and try very hard to devote themselves to God and not to be hypocrites, not to cheat anyone, to be the real thing. And people start to notice, hey, these people are really devoted. They're actually giving themselves to God. We should help these people. And so help pours in. Help pours in. And a religious institution founded upon austere monastic principles begins to grow and to expand and to arrange facilities. And for some time it goes very well. And then you get later generations of monks or devotees or spiritual workers who are born into or who simply join an institution that already is doing very well for itself. And you can see where this goes. I mean, you go down the road and then corruption starts to set in. People become disgusted because these so-called priests and monks or tyagis, whatever, they're a bunch of hypocrites. And then as people become disgusted, some other group of sincere people arise and say, no, we're going to do the real thing and just live simply. And gradually they get support. And then it goes around like this if you study history. So I would be cheating you if I did not admit that the historical marriage between spiritual institutions and fundraising and all that stuff is it's an interesting relationship. And at times, the funding of spiritual institutions results truly in the salvation of the world, and at times it results in widespread corruption and hypocrisy. And these things go through different historical phases. I wanted to mention this because it's real. It's actually true. And even when there's not corruption or overt hypocrisy, there can be mismanagement. And I personally am not pious enough to happily give my money to someone else to be mismanaged. I have not achieved that state of piety yet. So this is the situation in general. Apart from ISKCON Atlanta, this institution right here, the general historical situation is that if we are to save the world, we must in fact mobilize, we must organize programs, we must move forward. That requires funding. And yet there are clearly dangers in the funding of a spiritual institution or a religious institution. That's the real world. That's the real world. Having said all that, what do we do here? I mean, here we are in Atlanta, those of us who actually are permanently associated with this institution. And we have Prabhupada sitting there. Prabhupada said very clearly that it's simply a neophyte, superficial thing to stay in the temple and just ring the bells. I mean, Prabhupada himself went to the temple and rang bells. So it's not that going to the temple and chanting Hare Krishna and even ringing the bell is somehow beneath us. I mean, Prabhupada himself did it. In fact, in Mayapur, there was a big bell hanging from the ceiling and he would circumambulate the deities at our Mayapur temple and ring the bell. But if we merely do that, Prabhupada said, it's a very neophyte situation. Gaudiya Vaishnavism will not save the world unless it is a mature Gaudiya Vaishnava movement. In other words, if you study the teachings of Krishna consciousness, the teachings of our sacred books, you will find that the great sages and Krishna himself have ranked the devotees. There are different levels of devotional service. And of course, for convenience, they're divided into three. There is the Kanishta Adhikari. Kanishta in Sanskrit means lowest. Someone at the lowest level, the neophyte, who can only see God in the temple, and as soon as the neophyte walks out the door, everything's up for grabs. And it's all happening only in this one room. God is not everywhere. He, like the rest of us, lives in a room. So that's the Kanishta Adhikari. Then above that, there is the Madhyama Adhikari, the middle position. in which one realizes that Krishna is everywhere. And therefore, a Madhyamadikari forms four kind of relationships. The Madhyamadikari, the middle position devotee, this is what Prabhupada wanted us to be at least, the middle position devotee, first of all, sees Krishna as his or her Lord, that my ultimate devotion is for Krishna. The middle devotee sees other devotees. These are my natural friends because these people understand Krishna. These people are also devoted to Krishna. These are my friends. And even in that friendship, there are actually different levels, explained in Upadeshamrita. And then there are innocent people. The world is full of innocent people who could love Krishna, who are not against Krishna, if only they could know about Krishna. And the middle devotee is energetic, enthusiastic to help these people. And the Uttamadikari, of course, is one who actually sees Krishna and sees everything as part of Krishna. And also that highest devotee comes down and preaches. So ISKCON cannot be a Kanishta institution, which would be that we accept Krishna, but all of our devotion is focused on the deity of the temple. This specifically mentioned in the Bhagavatam. Archayam eva, only for the deity. It's specifically mentioned in the Bhagavatam. Archayam eva, only for the deity. Only for the archa, vigraha. Archayam eva haraye put, and so on. And we don't really honor the devotees, we don't honor other living beings. So, I guess what I want to say to you is, and I'm saying this sincerely because I am too old to start cheating people at this age. What I want to say to you is that, a couple of things. First of all, I believe that Atlanta ISKCON is trustworthy at this point. And that's why I'm personally here. Because I have a lot of things to do in life, but I'm here because I believe in this project, and I believe that actually it is being managed properly and sincerely, and it is actually trustworthy. And the second thing I want to say is that, in other words, we are not in a stage of historical corruption at this point. I think we're acting in a very good stage. I think you're all very fortunate to be alive at a time when this spiritual institution is actually very healthy and becoming healthier all the time. And another thing is that for Prabhupada's sake, not for the sake of paying some bills, but for Prabhupada, just for our convenience, or because there was not so that the devotees in the temple can continue a lazy lifestyle and live at your expense. It's not about that. Although, anyway, at different times and places, it has been about that. But the point here is that, I think there's a misunderstanding, which created by us and no one else, about what it means to be a member of ISKCON. And so I want to talk about that, because I think it's really important. I think our progress, in order for us to organize ourselves and to push forward Prabhupada's movement for his pleasure, not for anyone's vanity, not for anyone's personal comfort, but for Prabhupada and Krishna's satisfaction, in order for us to truly push forward this movement so it fulfills its historical mission, we have to be organized, and I don't think we have to reinvent the wheel. In other words, just like we're speaking English right now, we live in a culture in which people speak English for the most part. And so we don't have to invent a separate language. Well, to some extent. We don't have to invent a separate language to communicate. We can use English. We don't have to invent new laws of engineering to build roads and buildings for Krishna. There already are laws of, there already are sound principles of engineering, and so on. So similarly, there are sound principles for organizing religious institutions throughout the world. There are perfectly sound principles, organizational principles, which work as effectively as the principles of engineering work when we do our buildings. And if we study, and Prabhupada told us to study successful institutions, he didn't tell us to be obsessed with being different in everything even if to be different, we have to be inferior. So if we study other institutions, what we find is that in any normal institution, people are members of it. And there is some formality to that membership. And by that, I don't mean that the members treat each other in a cold, reserved, official way. There's some formality in the sense that there's a clear definition, there's a clear understanding of what it means to be a member. It's just like if you go to a university, there are very clear boundaries. You are or are not a registered student at that university. It's very clear. And therefore, like Emory University up the road here, it's not fuzzy, it's very clear. Even as Emory, like any serious university, has outreach programs, extension schools, public cultural resources, etc., etc. But there's a very clear standard. You are or are not a member of the Emory University community. And the same is true for corporations. You are or are not an official member of a particular corporate team. And the reason, the same thing is true for churches and synagogues. And the reason the world functions this way is because it works. The world doesn't function that way because they're meat eaters. It doesn't function that way because they're materialists, because they think they are their bodies. The world functions that way because it works. It's a sound principle for organizing human beings effectively. Now there's another point, and that is I think ISKCON has to, free itself from a misunderstanding, a collective misunderstanding about what the word means, membership or member. And I personally, in my own analysis, traced this misunderstanding as follows. If you look at ISKCON's history, when Prabhupada went to India in 1970, when he went back to India, the social situation in India was such that because in India, families were much more united, and therefore the members were much more attached as a family, and because in general, historically, India was going through a period of economic concern to develop economically and materially, it was very difficult for Prabhupada to persuade young people, as he did in America, to join his movement full time. In America, Prabhupada had preached, people had joined his temples, young men and women, they had become full-time missionary workers, they had gone out and sold Prabhupada's books and other products, and this created an economy which allowed the establishing of permanent temples all around the world, based on this economy. When Prabhupada went to India, this didn't happen. There were young people that were interested, but their families, their parents would say, no, you cannot become a full-time devotee. You've got to stay in college or, you know, become an engineer or whatever. And the young people were too attached to their families to say no, and therefore it just didn't happen. And the few people that did join ISKCON tended to be people who were not so educated and who were deeply attracted by the material benefits of joining ISKCON. And Prabhupada himself complained about this in India. Therefore, Prabhupada created an alternative plan to be able to establish permanent centers in India, since what was working in the Western countries was not working in India. This alternative plan was called life membership. And basically, I think back in those days, people would pay 1,111 rupees, because in India, one is, I don't know, you know, it's just a popular number. I mean, donations end with one and so on for various reasons. So for 1,111 rupees, someone became a life member. They got a set of Prabhupada's books and they could stay so many days in various ISKCON temples. So it was a great deal. It was a great deal. And many respectable people throughout India, large numbers of people, in fact, became life members of ISKCON. So the strategy worked and we were able to push on our missionary activities in India and bring Krishna consciousness back to the country of its origin. Now, there was one problem with this, in my opinion, which has surfaced later, and that is, in the collective consciousness of ISKCON, Membership. The word membership is associated with people who are actually not intimate members of ISKCON. Because some of the life members were actively engaged in ISKCON, but most of them, to be honest, gave their donations, were not actively or regularly serving ISKCON, although they were certainly sympathetic and well-wishers. And so the word member in ISKCON came to mean someone who's not actually very much engaged in the society. In other words, the opposite of what a member is in any regular church or synagogue or mosque or even mandir. The word took on an opposite meaning. So that if we ask sometimes someone who was, say, an initiated devotee to become a member, they're almost insulted by that. Because are you saying that I'm just, you know, a life member? So we have this interesting situation, which I think in order for ISKCON to move forward, this has to be sorted out. And Atlanta, I think, is a very good place to sort it out, because why not? So all the devotees, I think most of the devotees who were initiated, who at one time lived in a Krishna temple, who were full-time workers in ISKCON's mission, they grew up conditioned to think that, well, I'm a real devotee, I'm not just a member. And I didn't even see that this language is very confusing and more than a little dysfunctional. Because the simple fact is that we need to be normal in certain ways. It's like when we build a building, we need normal engineering. When we speak English, we need normal English. When we deal with, for example, insurance companies to make sure we don't lose our temple, we need to have normal insurance policies. And in the same way, in order to move forward as a spiritual institution, we need to have normal membership. We need to have normal membership. Now, another point I want to make is that one of the complaints we used to always have in the old days and in the not so old days in temples around the world is the one thing devotees really didn't like, for good reason, is a type of ad hoc management where rather than have like a steady service, this is what I do every day, I can get regulated, I can depend on it, I can organize my life, it's like suddenly, well, you have to do this now, there's an emergency here, or there's, you know, we just got a leak there and a fire broke out over here, and Bhakta Mori didn't take his medicine, he's, you know, hanging from the chandeliers. So I think anyone that has reached a certain level of maturity and seriousness in life wants to know, like, what's going on, what's the program, what do I have to do? You want to be able to rely on it and depend upon it, like, this is the way it works. And so consider, from the point of view of those of us who are responsible to not only maintain this temple, but to actually expand the mission, because otherwise we are simply not really understanding Prabhupada. We cannot follow Prabhupada if we simply stay inside this room. That's the point. We have to do other things. And so from the point of view of those who want to, in other words, ISKCON in Atlanta has to know how it's going to go on. We have to stop the insanity of ad hoc emergency appeals for this or for that. There has to be a reliable, steady economic situation in this temple, not because we're just another hypocritical religion that's really after money, not for that reason, but because actually we want to get to our real mission. We want to be free, without anxiety, to focus our full attention on spreading Krishna consciousness. So if those of us who are responsible to Prabhupada directly for his mission in Atlanta, if we have to focus our mental and physical energy on just paying bills, the preaching mission just doesn't go on. That's a simple fact of life. And so what I'm asking the devotees here to do is to please support this initiative to normalize us as an institution. So we're not eccentric. So we're not weird. So we're not still hampered by some of the old hippie notions which the early members of ISKCON brought in and which became institutionalized, sacralized. In other words, we have to become, in certain ways, a normal institution so that we are just as functional as any other institution and we can focus most of our attention on actually helping people and fulfilling Prabhupada's dream and Lord Chaitanya's dream. So I'm requesting everyone to please, if you have any idea in your head that to be a member of ISKCON means that you're sort of like an outsider, or if you have any idea that this is another one of these ad hoc, cockeyed membership drives, which all it means is the temple didn't manage their money well last month, and so now we have a membership drive. That's not what this is about. We have a membership program. It's up on that board. I won't read it, but I think it's actually generous because we all need to declare ourselves as members of ISKCON Atlanta. We need to commit ourselves. We all need to pull together. It's like when you're a kid and you're playing football or soccer or something. If someone on your team is kind of not doing their share and the team doesn't do well, it's just not good. Everyone has to really... I don't know what to say. I don't see the problem. I think it's such an obvious good thing that we should all commit ourselves formally. We have to get over this problem of thinking that to be a member of ISKCON is something for outsiders. I'm an initiated devotee. Why do I have to become a member? It just doesn't work that way. If anyone has any question or comment, perhaps I could take some time, because I really, really hope that we can, in the appropriate ways, be normal and just be a normal, functional, spiritual institution and get on with our business. Yes, Vedasana Prabhu?
Yeah, question.
Oh, I'm sorry, yes?
I just had a comment. I mean, if you look at the churches around... These days, there's so many big churches being built that are, they're calling them mega churches, and they're beautiful, and people are attracted by it. And it's because people just come by their common sense, they understand that I have to support the mission. So, it's almost like if we can't think that way, we're dysfunctional. We're doing a disservice to Prabhupada's mission. It just seems like a natural thing for everybody to do. Who comes to this temple on a regular basis, whether it's once a month or on Sundays, pledge something every month. It's just like paying a bill. I mean, in the Christian church, it's 10% tithing. Whether it's 1% or 3%, it seems like everybody should do that, just so we can be, like you say, a normal church, to be able to move forward.
Jai Dunn.
Yeah, I just have a comment because I think this is a really wonderful idea and everything, but we have to also remember the fact that if membership is based on making a donation, that there are devotees who are doing service, there should be some sort of, equalizing factor in a sense, because a lot of people think that if I make my donation, then I don't have to serve. But you make advancement in Krishna consciousness by doing service, and there are many people who financially are not able to make donations if they do lots of service. So, it shouldn't be seen as though, if I can't give anything, then, I can't really do anything either.
That's a very good point, and I'm sure Vedasara and I'm sure he'd be very happy to, if someone asked, for example, there's one, I hate to get into numbers because I don't want to sound like, just a priest after money, because I'm not, and I personally don't want anything from anyone in this room for myself. I can say that very clearly. I don't need anything, I don't want anything, and I don't need a penny from anyone in this room. So that's not what it's about. What it's about is this. The membership begins at $31 a month. If someone, First of all, people that come to the temple and do service are wonderful devotees, and we are grateful for their service. It's not just about money. At the same time, since one can be a member for $1 a day, I don't think we should overemphasize, or I don't think we should give the impression that we have large numbers of people that can't afford $1 a day. Because if you look at the nature of the world today, it's a very, very small amount. Now, someone actually, $1 a day is actually too much for them, that's okay. They may still be a great Vaishnava, maybe the best member we have. And if that person wants to come and do service, their service is very gratefully accepted, and we will honor them for what they are, a very good devotee. So if someone finds themselves in that situation, yes, by all means, talk to Vedasara. There's no question. I mean, no sincere devotee will ever be rejected on those grounds. Ever. To balance it, however, I don't think we should overemphasize $31 a month. That's $1 a day, and that's where the membership starts. So I think in general, we should all come forward. And if someone finds themselves in that situation, then, as I said, no sincere member will ever, ever be rejected on any financial grounds here. So, any other comment?
Maharaj, can Baba Bhajapur speak a little bit about it? Because he was here for so many years. And he's been very consistently maintaining this temple so nicely. Maybe we can hear a few words from him.
I'd like one of the quotes I hear from National Public Radio.
Can everyone hear? Why don't you grab this?
I mean, most people are familiar with the National Public Radio, NPR. And every year they have two drives for fundraising. And I find it very interesting because sometimes I listen to their news shows and things like that. So when they're having the fundraising drive, the person who's conducting the drive says, now you're listening to this radio station. Have you pledged? Because if you haven't pledged, someone else is paying for you to be able to listen to this radio show right now. So please make your pledge. So we all come to the temple. And if I'm not personally contributing to help support the temple, then I'm actually, I don't use the word taking advantage of it, but I'm using the resources that others are providing for all of us. So I think if we look at our lives and say, well, what can I actually contribute? If I'm not able to give 31, like Mara said, you can talk to Vedasara, so I can give 15, I can give 10, but I think we can all do something. And I mentioned a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago, that when we come to the Sunday program and the tray comes around, the donation tray, you know, the tray with the RT, we can make a decision there. Well, I can put something there or not put something there, because that donation actually goes to help the temple. So what I decided for myself is that every week I'm going to put $5 there. Forget about just the membership, but just here's another chance to donate. But in order for me to put that $5, I have to make arrangements around Thursday. I have to start thinking, well, I need that $5, do I have it, do I need to get change? Like today, I had to stop and get change. Anyway, so to make sure I have that $5 to donate for the service of the deities. So if we're thinking about how to do it, then the ways and means will manifest themselves. But if we resign ourselves and say, well, I can't do it, then the idea won't come, the realization won't come, the resources won't come. So if we understand, as Maharaj is saying, that coming to Srila Prabhupada's temple is a great blessing, it's a great fortunate opportunity for us, to make sure that it goes on in the future for the next generation is our responsibility. To make sure that happens. So if we have to work a little harder at our jobs or make a little extra money to achieve that first level, somehow or another, I believe if we put it in our hearts, we can do that. And that will help support the temple. And as Marge is saying, by this whole historical understanding of religion, we're at a point now in Atlanta where we can all give our 100% commitment to this project and to preaching and spreading the mission of Srila Prabhupada. I've been very fortunate to work with some devotees in North America because the idea is that we want to recognize all the preachers around the country. So we have a goal. The goal is to identify all the devotees who are using their homes to preach the message of Lord Chaitanya, and then in 3 years to double that number, to make that happen around the country. So now ISKCON is in a position where we can actually, with faith, in these temples that are existing now, there's only 30 or 40 temples in North America, but we can have faith in these temples, Atlanta being one, give our support, make a sacrifice. The big point is, in order to have 31, 51, or 100, whatever that number is, we have to make a sacrifice. If we're not willing to make a sacrifice, how will we advance? The only way we can make advancement is by sacrifice. And so Marge is asking us to make a financial sacrifice as well as a physical. So the only thing I can say is that I'm going to try my best, and I hope and pray that all of you will do the same.
Yes.
Can I have a mic one second?
Yeah, sure.
I wanted to comment.
I just wanted to point out that ever since this membership has started, we've gotten very good response, and a lot of the devotees are extremely inspired that we are actually actively, strategically have a plan to support and maintain and develop this temple. And some very, very dedicated devotees, I just wanted to name one devotee. There's devotee Kumar who was sitting there in the middle. I mean, he's a Mathura Sevak on the board, and he once walks into the kitchen and he saw that the kitchen was in a very structurally challenged condition. How's that? And he made a commitment on the spot that I want to do this service to Srila Prabhupada and to their lordships. Apart from just maintaining his family and his children, he went out of his way to find a part-time job to work, instead of giving time to his family, he went and got a part-time job to pay for the renovation of the kitchen, 50% of the renovation of the kitchen. So that's the kind of dedication that was actually very inspiring to the devotees who try and help the other devotees and spread the movement in this city of Atlanta. And there was another Mataji named Sashimukhi. She worked, she's not here today, I wish she was. She works so hard day in and day out, and every penny that she makes, she saves up, and she puts it towards the kitchen. Now we have a very beautiful kitchen, nicely renovated. She spent over $15,000 just from her just working at a Steinmart. Saved up money to do the service to the Lordship. So this kind of dedication to serve and help assist spreading this mission of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is extremely inspiring. I just wanted to share that with everybody. Thank you.
So I won't go on forever with this, but I have to pray to Krishna to somehow give me words to make clear to you what I see very clearly, and that is membership in ISKCON, and not forget money now, but membership, just to be a member of ISKCON, has to mean something tangible. In other words, if I went to a university, if I got into a very good university, and I went there and I found that anyone could just go there, it didn't matter their qualification, it didn't matter whether they went to class or didn't go to class, it was just like, in other words, it's just all completely open, and there's no special recognition to those who actually join the university or register or go to all their classes. It's just a big free-for-all. I wouldn't feel any particular pride or sense of accomplishment or anything. Solidarity with the other students. I mean, think practically. To be a member of ISKCON has to be something at one level official. It can't just be that if someone wanders, comes over here once in a while and feels like it today, I'm a member of ISKCON, and tomorrow, I mean, it's something else. It has to be every serious institution in the world has some formal means by which they identify, this is a list of the people who are our members. And as Jayadaini said, it cannot be reduced to money, but I would much rather live in a different yuga, I would much rather live in a different culture where we could just act as Brahmins and people could just come and, you know, bring us produce or some milk or something, and the community provided a place. But this is the world I was born into. So I would urge you to see that we have to make membership in ISKCON be something real and tangible, so that we know exactly this is the group of people who are members of ISKCON. And then we can invite them, because otherwise, I think that's one of the problems spreading this movement. Because unlike every other religious institution, we can't even ask people to become members of ISKCON because there is no such thing. Or at least there wasn't. In other words, if I meet some interested person and I say to them, please become a member of our community, unless there's something which is tangible, that, okay, it means you do this, it means that, or whatever, if there's nothing formal about it whatsoever, it's just a mood, it's just a feeling inside yourself. It's just like bhakti yoga. There is, bhakti is ultimately an emotion, but there's a formality to it. There's a formal structure. You get up at a certain time if you want to practice strictly. You chant 16 rounds, you follow four principles. That at this level, you can be initiated. At that level, you can have second initiation. If one takes sannyas, if one gets married. All the meaningful activities of human life involve some kind of external structure and formality. It's not that if a man and woman feel happy together, they call themselves a couple, and if their feelings change, they dissolve the relationship. That's not what marriage is really about. You actually, people get married. There's a formality. And yes, there's a marriage license you buy. And there is a piece of paper. And the piece of paper, marriage isn't just a piece of paper, but the piece of paper is a symbol, is a confirmation, is a reminder, is a declaration of a deep commitment. And the fact that the deep internal commitment has its external expression makes human life and human society sane and manageable and transparent. The world can't run simply on feelings. Families can't be run on feelings without formal commitments. Universities can't be run on feelings and intentions without formal rules and commitments for membership. ISKCON has to come to a more serious stage where to be a member of it is something that you commit yourself to, you publicly commit yourself to. There are formal external confirmations of the commitment you made. The other members know who stands with them. Who has also committed? Who are the people you can count on because they've made the same commitment you have? It's not just that. I mean, it has to be something tangible and visible in order for us to organize and move forward. We have to be a normal spiritual institution in that sense. So this is for me, frankly, this temple is not in financial difficulty at this present time, although the president, who would like very much to go out and help people to be happy by giving them Krishna, can't do so because he has spent a lot of his time paying the bills. So it's not about money. It is about teaching Krishna consciousness. And for me, maybe I'm a little whatever, cerebral or something, but for me, it's a very real thing. For me, having all of us formally commit ourselves, apart from the money, because we're not in financial difficulty right now, although we are bogged down time-wise. For me, the fact of coming to a mature, serious level where membership becomes a tangible, defined thing, apart from any financial consideration, is equally important. I care as much about what it will do for our consciousness, our solidarity, as I do about the money. I mean, perhaps I even care more about that. Because I want to belong to a serious, mature institution. I am sorry I ever became a hippie, and I will never do it again. And I want to belong to a serious, mature institution that in relevant, appropriate ways is just normal. I don't want to be eccentric, and I don't want to be associated with eccentricity. We should be normal and move forward and do things that work. Take the proven path that Prabhupada told us to take. So, thank you all very much. a show of hands. I'm kind of shy to do it because if someone doesn't raise their hand, I don't want them to get embarrassed. So I'm kind of caught between a rock and a Veda place. What should we do? I mean, I don't. If we ask for a show of hands, then I'm afraid someone that doesn't raise their hand may be embarrassed. So what do we do?
Close
your
eyes. Members will feel proud to be supportive of the.
Okay, without any stigma attached to them, it doesn't raise their hand. I mean, how many people here feel that they would like to publicly, commit themselves that I'm an official follower of Prabhupada and I'm a member of this society?
Can I take down the names?
Yeah, please. I mean, I don't want to just make you all sit here while Vedasara writes your names down. But please, if you, I'm asking you to commit yourself to Prabhupada publicly, in the sense to say I am a member of ISKCON. You know that I'm a member of ISKCON, and I want to, in some appropriate, just as I formalize my marriage, just as we formalize childbirth, as we formalize university education. Let us formalize in the right way the fact that we are members of ISKCON. We are official followers of Prabhupada in a way that will allow this very sincere devotee, Vedasara, to use his considerable abilities to go out and actually save poor, suffering souls. Let him go out and do that by giving him the peace of mind to know that the basic institution will go on every month. And he doesn't have to scramble every month. He does it, he's successful, we're not in trouble. But please let him go out and preach. So, thank you very much. Please give him your name. Hare Krishna.